Psalm 3, Chapter 17, The Parson's Cause. A particular area of trouble with England over the Anglican establishment appeared during this period in the colony of Virginia. Of the 70 or so Anglican clergy in Virginia, the bulk were moderate, liberal, and easygoing, in keeping with the low church moderation of Virginia Anglicanism. In the western valley of Virginia, the local vestry, the important local political organ in that province, included Presbyterians and other dissenters for many years, since the valley was almost exclusively dissenter. Local vestries, furthermore, selected their ministers, who rapidly fell into the tolerant and liberal spirit of religion in Virginia. A little knot of high church Anglicans bitterly opposed this condition and strove to bring church and British control over ecclesiastical and other affairs of the colony. These men, largely English-born, clustered in and around the faculty of the College of William and Mary. In the fall of 1755, Virginia passed the first of its Twopenny Acts. Since Virginia's major currency was tobacco, its dues, contracts, and obligations were generally payable in that commodity or in more convenient warehouse receipts for quantities of tobacco. In such a system, a poor tobacco crop and a consequent rise in tobacco prices injured debtors and advantaged creditors. In 1755, a year of high tobacco prices, there was inaugurated a Virginia practice of fixing tobacco at an arbitrary price of 2 pence a pound. This at a time when the market price of tobacco was far higher than that. Virginians generally approved the measure because the main creditors or receivers of fixed obligations in tobacco were the tax collectors and the receivers of government fees. The Twopenny Act caused a welcome reduction in the real economic burden of taxation and government spending on the Virginians, and did this precisely during a time of economic crises when such relief was most needed. Government bureaucrats receiving fixed fees in tobacco lost a heavy windfall as a result of the Twopenny Act. Particularly affected were the Anglican parsons, who each received a fixed sum of a little over 17,000 pounds of tobacco per year. The knot of high church ministers zealously protested the Twopenny Law. A small clique of parsons, including 4 professors at William and Mary, sent several bitter protests to the Bishop of London. They were led by the Reverend John Cam of York County, a professor of divinity at William and Mary. The 1755 law was meant to be in force for 10 months only, after which the crop crisis would be over. The most important of the Virginia Twopenny Laws was passed in the fall of 1758, amid a catastrophic drought that lowered Virginia's tobacco production by nearly 90%. A fixed maximum price of 2 pence a pound was placed on tobacco for the following year. The Tory faction of the Virginia establishment was embittered at the loss of its windfall gains. The market tobacco price had risen to 6 pence a pound. Half of the Anglican clergy of the colony convened and with dispatch sent John Cam to England to plead their parson's cause for royal disallowance of the law. Cam took with him the minister's representation of the clergy of the Church of England. The representation bitterly and incorrectly denounced the Twopenny Act as deliberately designed to injure the Anglican clergy, and angered the Virginians by warning that the royal prerogative was being violated by the colony. The Anglican clergy were thus urging a royal veto over the self-governing acts of the Virginians. and went from there to urge the nullifying rather than the mere setting aside of the law, so that the twopenny act would be null and void from the beginning. The importance of this stemmed from the short-term nature of the crisis and of the law. If it could be voided from the beginning, Virginia would be liable for a large retroactive salary to its established clergy. The Virginia Assembly countered the appointment of Cam in early 1759 by appointing its own agent in London and selecting a committee of correspondents to carry on the struggle. The argument was now carried to England, where Virginians were further embittered by a vicious attack upon them by Bishop Thomas Sherlock of London, who had long been one of the prime movers in the scheme for an American episcopate. Sherlock leveled false accusations of a deliberate attack on the Virginia clergy, and then went on in a crescendo of calumny to charge the Virginia Assembly in its passing of the Twopenny Act with committing an act of treason, and I do not know any other name for it in our law. Sherlock went on to denounce the increasing number of dissenters, largely Presbyterians, in the colony. The Cam petition, aided by Archbishop Secker, traveled favorably through the ranks of the British bureaucracy. Finally, in August 1759, the Privy Council disallowed the two Twopenny Acts. It also went beyond this to order the Virginia governor not to sign in the future any such law that did not have a suspension clause delaying execution of the law until the king should approve, a serious threat to the self-rule of the colony. The crown had merely disallowed the Twopenny Act rather than nullified it from the start. The outcome of the dispute was therefore still unclear, a fact that would rankle Virginia-British relations for 8 more years. The Reverend Mr. Cam and a few other Tory parsons immediately decided to sue in the courts for the missing back pay, and if these cases were won, total nullification would be a fact. The Virginia taxpayers would then be burdened with huge windfall salary payments to the established clergy. The Assembly and its Committee of Correspondence decided to back the vestries in the court cases, and its Committee of Correspondence warned that the royal decision called into question the powers of the Virginia legislature to make temporary laws for the public weal. The Assembly in late 1760 petitioned the Crown for power to pass such temporary measures, but in vain. News of Bishop Sherlock's bitter blast particularly infuriated Virginians and set off a pamphlet war in the colony. Two of Virginia's leading planter oligarchs, Colonel Richard Bland, Jr. and Colonel Landon Carter, both burgesses and both Anglicans, attacked Sherlock and became involved in a series of exchanges with John Cam. The Bland family was intermarried with such eminent planter families as the Randolphs, and the Carters with the Randolphs, Byrds, and Harrisons. Bland's pamphlet, A Letter to the Clergy, 1760, was notable for a sardonic statement on the royal prerogative. Like the King of Babylon's decree, it may, for aught I know, almost force the people of the plantations to fall down and worship any image it shall please to set up. Moreover, as salus populi est suprema lex, every consideration must give place to it, and even these royal instructions may be deviated from with impunity. But the major threat lay in the court suits of the Reverend Mr. Cam and 4 of his fellow ministers, for their victory would mean that the Twopenny Act had been void from the start and that the government would have to reimburse the ministers. The slow processes of the courts kept the whole issue alive and festering. The first case to be decided was that of Reverend Alexander White of King William County, White's case was turned over in toto in the fall of 1762 to the jury, which naturally found for Virginia. In the case of the Reverend Thomas Warrington, decided soon afterward, the Elizabeth City County Court, headed by George Wythe, sustained the original validity of the Twopenny Act. Furthermore, it also found for the defendant. The third case to emerge was that of the Reverend James Maury of Louisa County, and was decided in Hanover County Court. On November 5, 1763, Judge John Henry decreed that the Twopenny Act had been null and void from the start. The only problem remaining was a jury trial fixing the amount of damages due to Maury. The trial was held in December. To Maury's disgust, the jury included the vulgar herd, two of which were ardent New Light Presbyterians. Dissenters had obvious reason to be hostile to levying taxes upon themselves for the benefit of an Anglican establishment. The great significance of the Maury trial was the emergence upon the scene of the brilliant young lawyer Patrick Henry. Henry, son of Judge John Henry, a leading planter of Hanover County, was a nephew of a venerable Anglican minister, the Reverend Patrick Henry, who was one of the ministers filing suit against the colony. Young Patrick had every family incentive to be on the Tory Anglican side of the dispute. Instead, hired despairingly at the last minute, Henry, presumably in a helpless situation, radicalized the atmosphere and captured the imagination of the colony in a dramatic speech to the jury. In short, Henry escalated the dispute straight up to the crown. By annulling the good and necessary Twopenny Act, the king had violated the original compact between king and people, by which the latter had promised obedience in return for royal protection of their rights. Therefore, concluded Henry inexorably, a king, by disallowing acts of so salutary a nature from being the father of his people, degenerated into a tyrant, and forfeits all rights to his subjects' obedience. At that point, the Reverend Mr. Maury recounted that the more sober part of the audience was struck with horror. Peter Lyons, the leading lawyer of the area, and Maury's counsel cried out at this that Henry had spoken treason, and murmurs of treason arose from the audience. But Henry, unruffled, continued to denounce bitterly the Anglican clergy. The clergy of Virginia, on refusing to acquiesce in the law, ought to be considered as enemies of the community, and Maury and his colleagues should be not rewarded, but stripped of their appointments. In a stirring peroration, Henry warned that unless the jury were disposed to rivet the chains of bondage on their own necks, he hoped they would not let slip the opportunity which now offered of making such an example of him, Maury, as might hereafter be a warning to himself and his brethren not to have the temerity for the future to dispute the validity of such laws. The jury, swayed and moved, brought in a verdict for token minimum damages, 1 penny. Judge Henry, moved to tears by his son's great speech, upheld the verdict, and the happy crowd, wild with delight, seized their champion and bore him on their shoulders in triumph around the courtyard. John Cam's own case came to trial in April 1764. This critical case was decided by the Council of Virginia, sitting as the Supreme General Court of the colony. The council decided against Cam by a vote of 5-4. Voting against Cam were John Blair of Williamsburg, sometime president of the council, John Taylor, William Byrd III, Robert Burwell, and Presley Thornton. Voting for CAM were Richard Corbin, Robert Carter, Peter Randolph, Surveyor General of the Customs, and Philip Ludwell Lee. William and Thomas Nelson of York County excused themselves from voting as parishioners of the Reverend Mr. CAM. White, Warrington, and Maury each had appealed their cases to the council, sitting as the Supreme General Court, and the Reverend Mr. Henry's suit was dismissed when the CAM case was decided. All the other cases were now ended, and the parson's cause rested on CAM's further appeal to the Privy Council in England. Meanwhile, the pamphlet war between CAM, on the one hand, and Bland and Carter, on the other, had renewed in 1763 and 1764. Finally, Richard Bland published in August 1764 his famous The Colonel Dismounted, which the historian Lyon G. Tyler has called the great critical paper of the Revolution. Colonel Bland began by asserting that the Virginians properly retain the rights of all Englishmen. He added, "Under an English government, all men are born free, are only subject to laws made with their own consent. If then Virginians are free-born and have the rights of Englishmen, then laws over them can be made only by their own representatives." This, Bland declared, applied to internal laws, whereas external laws are to be determined by Parliament. As for the royal prerogative, Bland warned that submission, even to the supreme magistrate, is not the whole duty of a citizen. Something is likewise due to the rights of our country and to the liberties of mankind. To say that a royal instruction to a governor is to have the validity of a law and must be obeyed without reserve is at once to strip us of all the rights and privileges of British subjects, and to put us under the despotic power of a French or Turkish government. Thus, the strictures of Bland and Henry emphasized the importance of the parson's cause in expanding the colonial conflict with Britain. From taxation by colonists themselves to legislation by the colonist. As historian Richard Morton puts it, from the principle of no taxation without representation, Virginians had moved on to no legislation without representation. During this debate, Virginians developed the great constitutional arguments, which they were to use effectively a few years later to justify rebellion. And it started Patrick Henry on his eloquent and outspoken defiance of British authority in America. Nullifying the twopenny acts by the Crown irritated the Virginians in many ways. It involved using royal power to annul a law popular in the colony. It attempted to impose suspension clauses to restrict further Virginian legislation. It gave rise to the parson's call for rendering such laws initially null and void. It rendered obnoxious to moderate Low Church Virginia an influential portion of the Anglican clergy devoted to High Church Tory principles. And it recalled the episcopal schemes of the leaders of the Church of England. Furthermore, the parson's cause polarized Virginian opinion, aligning the Anglican and dissenting laity of Virginia against the reactionary wing of the local Anglican clergy, the English Church, and the Crown itself. The parson's cause now rested on CAM's appeal to the Privy Council. To combat CAM's case, the Virginia Assembly's Committee of Correspondence in July 1764 prepared argumentation against CAM. The main brief was drawn up by committee member Robert Carter Nicholas of Williamsburg, who had been chief defense lawyer against Cam before the general court, and by George Wythe of Williamsburg. The case dragged on, unresolved, until the end of 1766, when the Privy Council dismissed Cam's appeal on a legal technicality. The Parsons cause was ended, but even then, unclearly and inconclusively, it left a significant legacy of opposition and hostility by Virginians to the Crown.